Hello, everybody. Okay, technology sorted out, possibly. Possibly sorted out, because although these lectures are being recorded on X360, I am not 100% sure which microphone they are taking things from. It may be that one, it may be this one. When I've listened to the recordings, they're a bit faint, but I can't find a button to switch the input. So we'll just have to hope for the best. At any rate, I am making separate recordings of these so we can fall back on those if necessary. Now, the plan today is to go through the last section of the axioms bit. Last time we got as far as this question, this rather mysterious question about people moving past each other. Plan is to finish off this chapter, go straight into chapter 3, and the plan is to spend lectures 3, 4 and 5 on chapters 3 and 4. So that should be about the right length of time. That's the goal anyway. We'll see what happens in actuality. So the remaining bit, so on to the last part of chapter 2. The remaining bit here is, there's not a lot to say about it in a way, but the important bit is the consequence of the second axiom. Okay. Before I go on to that, I want to just recapitulate this this quick question that we addressed at the very end of last time, because it is so very important. So if you recall, I have a friend moving past me in a rocket at relativistic speed, and relativistic speed means something moving at some appreciable fraction of the speed of light. I observe her watch be ticking slower than mine, for reasons that we haven't come to yet, but which we will get to very shortly. She examines my watch as I, at the same time, and the question was, is it ticking faster or slower than hers? And I asked you to think about that a little bit, and then I came back and said that the answer is, my watch will be ticking slower than hers. So her watch is ticking slower than mine, and my watch is ticking slower than hers. How can that be? We'll come to the reasons why that is not insane in a moment, but the point is that you don't even have to go on and talk about next chapter or the second axiom of relativity to know the answer to that, because the first axiom says you can't tell you're moving. And if one of us could discover that the other's watch was moving slow, in an absolute sense, then we could tell that we were the one that was moving, or vice versa, or whatever like that. So just by itself, the first axiom tells you there's something weird happening here, something extra weird, something more than the usual, more than the obvious weirdness happening here. As I say, we'll come back to that. We'll be returning to that definitely, but I wanted to impress upon you the last thing I said last time. And this is also a very important remark. This is Einstein's version of Galileo's principle of relativity. It's what he's following on from. But he says, and also, there's a second postulate, which is only apparently irreconcilable with the former. They appear to be inconsistent with each other when you look at them first. But he's saying that they're only apparently inconsistent with each other. That light is always propagated in empty space with a definite velocity c, which is independent of the state of motion of the emitting body. Now we have to understand what that means. Now, there's a number of things. Can we go on? I'll leave that in a moment. There's a number of things that the speed of light could mean. It could mean, if I have a torch and I shine it against the wall, how fast does the light leave? It could mean, how fast does the light go through empty space? Like water waves on water. They have a speed, and that speed is relative to the water. Okay. Or the speed of light could mean, how fast is light moving when I see it, or when I detect it, or when I do an experiment which involves light. These are all three different things in principle that light could mean. And the first two, they both seem fairly obvious. It's the third one that is the case. The speed of light, the measured speed of light, is the speed of light that when you detect it, when it enters your eye, or your camera, or your physical apparatus. And it's that that's independent of the state of motion. So if I am going on a train going through a station at half the speed of light, and I shine a light forwards, then it'll leave my torch at the speed of light. Theta 10 to the meters a second. And anyone on the train who measures the speed of that light, however, will get 3 to 10 meters a second. And someone on the station platform who sees this light being shown from the train to them, to their eyes on the station platform, if they measure the speed of light, they will see it not as the speed of light plus a half, plus the speed of the train, they'll see it as just the speed of light. So bizarrely, what the second axiom is saying is that speeds don't add the way you expect when you're talking about light, but more generally when you're talking about things near the speed of light. So I'm shining the torch forward and shining it into the eyes of someone on the station platform. It's not speed of light plus the train; it's just the speed of light. And so something is happening there that makes those speeds not add in the way you expect. So I'm adding up weirdnesses here. Adding weirdnesses. Is that happening outside? That
it's the mic.
A mic. See. Right. That's not helpful. I'll try there. That's not really working, is it? I'm not touching it. You think it's the wire? I'll try attaching to myself some different way. Perfect. Okay, so I'm adding up weirdnesses here. And the resolution is coming soon, I promise. So the point here is that is basically all I have to say about the second axiom. It's strange, but go with it for the moment. The last point that is important to mention in the notes is just I'll point you towards section 221 on the idea of synchronizing clocks. I'm not going to say much about it because it's there as a sort of pre-placed footnote. So when you start thinking this through and go, hang on, but how do we have the same time everywhere? Because remember I said that when we make observations on the station platform of the train moving past, all the observers have synchronized clocks. You know, they all know where they are on the station platform because there's a scale marked along the station platform. And all the watches are synchronized because that's how we do it. And you may think, hang on, how do we organize that? Is there a problem there? And no, there isn't. There's a process mentioned in the notes, section 221, just for when you start worrying about that, go back and have a look at that. It all works out. But it would distract us to step through it just here. Okay, that is to make absolutely clear what is the key points here. There are only two postulates we're going to talk about. There are only two physical statements, two new things about the universe you didn't know. And all the rest is, in a sense, logic. It's the deductions. Meaning that they're physical statements, they're not logical statements. You can imagine them being otherwise. That's what I mean by physical statement. Galileo's principle of relativity, you can't tell you're moving. Postulate two, the speed of light has the same value in all reference frames. And I'll just mention in passing that there are a number of different things that postulate two could be. There's a number of alternatives there. One could spend a lot of time talking about this, but that is the probably the most useful way to make progress with. So before I go, I go on. While I'm changing the slides, are there any puzzles that are outstanding there? Talk to me. At all? Right. I mean, I think it's possible for you to think, okay, this is all transparent and clear. Why are you making so much of a fuss about this? That's perfectly reasonable. Some of the puzzles are maybe yet to come. I'm maybe over-egging this, it's weird bit, but I don't worry about it. Chapter 2. What we're going to talk about quite a lot is the idea of simultaneity. That's the question of two things happening at the same time. And again, why would you think that was a big issue? The reason it's a big issue is because there's a variety of types of confusion that happen if you don't think about these things in exactly the right way. So what I'm doing here is sort of training you to think about things of this type, and which be in the right way to avoid confusion. And a lot of you will see on the internet, think, oh my God, relativity is wrong because X. Or someone had come up with a new theory which doesn't involve relativistic time dilation or something because X. In almost all cases, these confusions, these wrong accounts of why relativity is wrong, come from not understanding the importance of thinking in the right way about simultaneous events. So that's where the confusion comes from. And it seems like we're making more of a fuss about this than it really warrants, but it is terribly important. Objectives. So this is a train carriage, just either sitting in train station, or we're just thinking about it from the point of view of the people in the train carriage. There's two observers, one at each end. And there's a light flash in the centre, you know, like a strobe or something, whatever, a flash of light, an event. Okay? And the light goes off in all directions. In particular, it goes off toward the front of the train carriage and toward the back of the train carriage. And it takes 3 units of time to get there. What are these units? We'll come to that. But they're very small units, clearly. Okay, it only takes three of them to get for light travel, say 3 meters. Then that's the time on the clock of the person at this end, the time on the clock of the person at that end. And there's absolutely nothing surprising about what I've just said there, or what you can see there. Because this light flash is in the middle of the carriage, so it takes the same amount of time to get to each end, so both of the people at each end will record the same time, the same time of arrival time of the light at the end. Nothing complicated there. Now, let's imagine the same thing happening, but this time not from the point of view of the people in the train carriage, but from the point of view of people standing on the station platform watching this train go past. How is that different? Okay, the top one there, that's the light flashing. Then, a very short while later, the light has travelled a little bit forward and backwards, and the train carriage has moved forward because it's moving. A little while later, the light has travels further out from the flash, and at the same time the train carriage has moved forward. So at this point, the light flash has arrived at the end of the back of the train carriage, and if you remember Einstein's remark, all our measurements of time are remarks about simultaneous events. So here, the light arriving at the end, at the back of the train carriage, and that observer's watch showing 3 are simultaneous events. They are 2 events which happen at the same place, at the same time. It's like 2 cars crashing. There's no ambiguity about that. So the light, so we have to know, this argument is saying, it has to be the case that this observer's watch shows 3 when the light arrives at the back. And the way we've drawn this has used the second postulate. Because you see, here, the light isn't moving forwards faster than it's moving backwards. It's not picking up some extra speed from the speed of the train. It's moving forward at the speed of light, which is why the back runs into it before the light going forwards has reached the front. If you were thinking of that in a Galilean world, then the light moving forward would have picked up some extra speed of the train, and so it would catch up at the front. Second axiom says that's not what happens. the light arrives at the back, but the light hasn't arrived at the front yet. So if we were to sort of take a photograph of this moving train at the instant when this arrives at the back, the watch, we can see it, so we can see through the windows of the train carriage, and we can see this observer's watch. That can't be reading 3 yet, because the light hasn't got there yet. It has yet to arrive. It has yet to get as far as 3. In other words, although in the train carriage, the back observer's watch reading 3 and the front observer's watch reading 3 are simultaneous events, they happen at the same time coordinate. In the station platform, the back observer's watch reading 3 and the front observer's watch reading something like 1, they are simultaneous events. They happen at the same time coordinate. Because you imagine this notional photograph taken of the train as it goes past. In other words, simultaneity is relative. These events are simultaneous in this frame. These events, 3 and 1, are simultaneous in this frame. Depending on what frame you're in, things that are simultaneous at different places are relative. There's no question about the light arriving at the back and that clock reading 3 because they happen at the same place. That's the two cars. You know, there's no ambiguity about two cars crashing. But two events which are separate, it depends. You are at this point allowed to go gasp, okay? But we have this is a straightforward deduction from the two. Mostly from the second axiom. Okay, that's a bit strange. So now imagine everyone goes back to where they started off, and we now have two trains going through the station at the same time, at the same relativistic speed, going in opposite directions. And we can see both of them. So the top one, that's the train's heading off in that direction. And by the same argument, the observer Barbara at the back there, observer Fred at the front there, 3 and 1 are simultaneous in our frame. But we all set things up so that at the same time that that's going past this, through the train station, there's another train, Yvette and Zebedee, who are going to do the same thing but in the other direction. And of course it's quite symmetrical, so in that case, the rear observer, the watch was showing 3, the front observer, Yvette, her watch was showing 1. Okay, so that makes sense. Right, now I've got to make sure I see the next bit in the right order. Because it's possible to confuse things. Okay. Now we're going to pause a moment and take another set of observations. Just a short fraction later, when both trains have moved slightly onwards, and there's some observer in the top carriage who can see who can see Zebedee's watch at that point, and we're going to leave that question mark there for the moment. But what we're going to assume, by the way, is that these two trains are going past like that. Okay, so they're very close to each other, so that Hélène or whatever is. Has her nose glued up against the train window, and can see Zebedee's watch as if she were co-located with it. So these are in principle at the same position. Okay, so there's no time of flight stuff. So hold on to that thought for a moment. And then a little while later, the trains have moved further forward, and Barbara and Zebedee see each other's clocks, and they're both showing 11. Okay, there's that. Now, like I said, I've got to see this in the right order. So everyone calms down, come back together, has a cup of tea, and discusses their results. And Barbara says, I saw the front of the other train at time 3. And Fred says, oh, that's interesting, because I saw the back of that train at time 1. So by time three, you know, when Barbara saw the front of the train, at time three, the back of the other carriage was well past Fred. And if you remember, last time I talked of how we would measure the length of a moving train. If that bench were moving or something were moving through here at high speed, the way we would measure the length of the moving thing is if everyone was looking at their watch and at a pre-arranged time, they looked up, and if they see the train in front of them, they write that down. And we measure the length of the moving object by asking, did you see the end of the train? You saw the end of the train, subtract one distance from one coordinate from the other, and that's the length of the moving train. That's our procedure for measuring the length of a moving object. But look what's happened here. At time three, Barbara's saying the front of the carriage was level with me, and Fred said, oh, well, at time three, the front of the carriage was past me. We don't know exactly where, but it was certainly past Fred. In other words, at time three, the front of the carriage was level with the observer down about here. In other words, the people in the top carriage have measured the other carriage, the bottom carriage, to be shorter than theirs. Okay? And the next thing they can do is, they'll park that thought for the moment. Fred remarks, I noticed that Zebedee's watch was 2 units faster than mine. Their watches are faster than ours. Their watches are set ahead of ours. But Barbara goes, no, because when I looked at Zebedee's watch, co-located with me, Zebedee's watch wasn't faster at all. So Fred has seen Zebedee's watch be 2 units fast. Barbara sees Zebedee's watch not be fast at all. In other words, Zebedee's watch is going slow. They have, and that's a measurement. It's not some weird optical illusion. The point of all this, making an observation local to you and blah blah blah. That is saying we are making observations here, measurements. It's not just this is not optical illusions. So the people at the top carriage have measured the bottom carriage to be shorter than theirs, and this clock to be moving slowly. But again, I say this whole everything here is symmetrical. So exactly the same line of argument can be made by Yvette and Zebedee. So they would measure the top carriage to be moving slower, to be shorter than theirs, its length to be contracted. And they would measure Barbara's clock to be initially ahead of theirs and later in time. So they would measure Barbara's watch to be moving slower than theirs. And it has to be, and it has to be the case. This isn't just a symmetry argument. That has to be the case by the first axiom. Because if one of them could see that the other was absolutely shorter, then they could tell they were moving. So this has to be symmetrical. And this is so what's happening here is that both of these sets of observers measure the other to be length contracted, and both of them measure the other to be time dilated. Length contraction, things get shorter. Time dilation, clocks go slow. And that's another thing you are quite permitted to be to gasp and stretch your eyes at. So I'll pause a moment there. The other outstanding puzzle that possibly can't be right because you will reread this and it'll percolate into your percolation. So, which of the following statements are true, referring to the observers at the front and back of the train carriage? So, Fred and Barbara's watch seem mutually synchronised with each other, and measuring their frame. Fred and Barbara's watches stay synchronised with the clocks in the other frame. Fred and Barbara measure the carriage to get shorter when they're moving. True or false? The first statement. All those say it's true. All those say it's false. Second statement. Fred and Barbara's watch stay synchronised with the clocks in the other carriage. True? False? Fred and Barbara measure the carriage to get shorter when they're moving. True? False? Good. Excellent model. I think the majority of the comfortable majority of everyone got that right. So we won't deny other than say yes. The whole thing about because Fred and Barbara aren't mutually aren't mutually moving. They're synchronized their watches by a procedure which we can talk about, and they stay synchronized. There's no complication there. You can hold on to that thought in thinking through these things. Yes, the whole point of this is that there's a difference in the measurement of the passage of time. And yes, it cannot be the case that Fred and Barbara measure their character is shorter when they're moving. A, because that would violate the principle of relativity. B, because as far as they're concerned, they're not moving. You know, they're standing in a train carriage. Okay, it happens that the world is moving past them at a high speed, but everything that happens when you're stationary has to happen in the train carriage as well. So that can't happen. Excellent. I should be going faster. Key points. Right. We'll move on and talk about the light clock. Now, this isn't a useful clock, but it's a way of materialising the passage of time in a way which depends on the moving speed of light, or the speed of light. So this is our light clock. It consists of something which flashes, a mirror at the top, and an observer back at the bottom again. And one tick of the light clock is flash, boing, detected. Okay? And the person who's standing by the light clock, so they are co-located with the flash, rather. They're co-located with the flash. They have a stopwatch. They see the light flash, start the stopwatch, the light travels a distance L, bounces off the mirror, comes back, travels a distance of 2L, and they stop the stopwatch. So they time how long it takes for that in their frame, in the watch of the person on the watch of the person standing by the detector. Nothing complicated there. So delta T prime is 2L over C, distance of speed times time. Distance of speed times time is another thing that you can hold on to. Now imagine that light clock is moving at a relativistic speed on a train, you know, carriage going through a station, blah, blah, blah. And now it's being observed by someone by a set of observers, including this one, on the station platform. The light flashes. By the time it makes it across to the other side of the light, of the light clock, the whole thing has moved along because it's moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light. And so by the time it bounces off the mirror at the top, it's bouncing off the mirror when it's over here. It's moved down the track a bit. And it bounces, comes back, and eventually arrives back at where it started, more or less, in that frame, and this time being observed by someone on the station platform. But, again, second axiom, the light moves at the speed of light. It doesn't get a speed boost from the fact that the flash light here is moving. Same speed, but it travels a longer distance. So the time it takes to go longer distance is speed times time, is C times that time. So that triangle from the line here is C delta T over 2. It's the total time it takes divided by 2. And if the whole thing is moving at speed V, then that distance from there to here is, of course, V delta T, distance of speed times time. So that thing there is half V delta T. Pythagoras' theorem. I'm going one of these is recorded on the Echo 360, and I don't know which one it is, so we'll just have to. Hope it's the right one. Oh, there you go. Hello. So what we have is C delta T over 2, V delta T over 2. That distance is L. Now, why is it L rather than L primed? Does that? I've just written down there that L, the same as in the light clock when we when it was stationary. So there isn't an L and an L primed. You may or may not have noticed, and that's because that doesn't change. And we can think, we can work out that it can't change by using the principle of relativity. Because imagine, I've said that there's length contraction along the direction of motion. Perhaps there's length contraction perpendicular to the direction of motion. Okay, let's go with that for a moment. Say you're driving along on this train, and say the length contraction the length contraction exists, and it had the effect of making that train axles shorter. Then the train wheels will fall into the in between the train tracks, and the whole thing will crash. I mean, that's a very bad thing, because there'd been a length contraction that way. But from the point of view of the people on the train, it's the world that's moving past them. So the train tracks are the ones that are moving, so they're going in the other direction. But if there's a perpendicular length contraction, then what will happen is the train track, the sleepers on the train will get shorter. And the distance between the tracks will get shorter. So the train wheels will end up outside the train track, it'll crash. Either way, it'll be a crash. But in one case, it's because from one point of view, it's because the train axle have got shorter and they've ended up inside the train tracks. And for the other view, if the sleepers have got shorter, the train wheels have ended up outside. You can't have both. It's not possible for there to be both. And that argument depended on the assumption that perhaps there was a perpendicular length contraction. So there can't be. So that's L and not L primed. Okay? So Pythagoras' theorem. We have, first of all, from the simple case detector, that we know that 2L is equal to C delta T primed. That's where delta T primed is the time, the round trip time on the watch of the person standing by this. So now we have C delta T squared over 2 squared plus is equal to L squared plus V delta T over 2 squared, just by Pythagoras' theorem. Or in other words, C squared delta T squared is equal to 2L squared plus C delta T squared. But we know what L is, so that's C delta T primed squared plus C squared delta T squared. I'm going to just ignore the cancel out the C's, and we end up. I've written the wrong thing. I've said that's V squared. Why did no one stop me? V squared. I'll write that. V squared delta T squared. V squared delta T squared, or delta T squared is equal to delta T prime squared plus V squared over C squared delta T squared. I'm making a rather meal of this algebra, but therefore delta T is equal to delta T prime is equal to delta T 1 minus V squared over C squared. Power of half, square root of. So this simple construction has allowed us to work out the relationship between the time between these two clicks as measured on the watch of the person on the station platform, and the time between these same two click new events on the watch of the person in the train, and that they are different. And we're going to write that as delta T is equal to gamma delta T primed, where gamma is equal to 1 minus E squared over C squared to the minus a half And you'll see that factor appearing again and again and again. So we've already got a mathematical expression for the time dilation effect, just for the two axioms and a bit of ancient Greek geometry. Is anyone aghast at that? A question?
Delta T prime,
that's the time on the watch of the person who's standing by the light clock. So the light clock is on the train. They're standing by there with their setup. So this, in standard configuration, is x prime x. That's the frame moving at speed v. The light clock is there, and delta t prime in that frame, and these two events are delta t in this frame. Standard configuration, meaning that the x and x prime axes are lined up together, and the clocks are synchronized to zero at the point where the frames were co-located. Okay. As you can check, at this point, this is a good prompt for you to go back and look at the section in chapter one, which said exactly what what standard configuration was. Okay. So this is essentially that question. When discussing the light clock, we saw the phrase one tick is timed at delta t seconds. So that's which is that the watch of person on the train, the watch of person on the platform edge, the station clock, or the time attached to the photon of light. Who would say it was the watch of a person on the train? Who would say it was the watch of a person on the platform edge? Who would say it was the station clock? Who would say it was the time attached to the photon of light? Who hasn't put their hands up yet? Okay, I'll go through it again. Put your hand up at something. Guess. It doesn't matter. I'm not keeping track of who says what. No one keeps track. I'll want you to just have to make some sort of commitment to yourself about which it is. Who would say it was the watch of a person on the train? Okay. Who would say it was the watch of someone on the platform edge? Who would say it was the station clock? Who would say it was the time attached to the photon of light? Okay. Chat to your neighbour. Tell them why you're right. Asking that again. Delta T in that construction. And remember, what we're talking about is the setup here. So delta T there is the watch of a person on the train, the watch of a person at the platform edge, the station clock, the watch time attached to a photon of light. Okay. It's the watch of a person on the platform edge. Okay. Because and this is always very important. It doesn't matter what is T and what is T primed. All the frames are equally good. But then this is why when you're working through problems like exercises like this, you always have to say T is the time in this frame, T prime is the time in this frame. You have to be explicit about it because all options are okay in principle. There's a sensible way of doing it, but the non-sensible ways are legitimate too. So the way I set this up, I could have set it up a different way. The way I did set it up was that delta t was the time of the observers, plural, on the station. Just T prime was the watch, the time on the watch of the person standing by the light clock and that moving. And they're different times. We could have defined them differently. We didn't in that way I set them up. And it's not on the station clock. Can anyone say why it isn't the time on the station clock?
Because it's not in like the same reference frame. Well, it's not in the same possession.
Yes, that's it. It is in the same reference frame. So the station and the station clock are not moving with respect to each other. So the station clock is fixed to the station. So it's going to be synchronized with delta T, with all the observers who are at rest in the station. But the one we are looking at, the person whose notes we are recording in delta T is the watch of a person who is standing by the bit where the light came back to the bottom of the light clock. That is simultaneous in their frame with everyone else in that frame, but it's their watch we're looking at. They are the observer that matters. So that's why, a question there.
Why does it matter so much that they're the same position or not the same position?
Oh, right. That's a very good question. Why does it matter? I think it matters because if we all would make sure that's the only person we're talking about, then we know exactly what we mean by the time of the event. It would be possible to see that and look at the station clock at the same time, and you could work it out. But it would involve doing all sort of extra sums about the light travel time and worrying about what's simultaneous and what's not. So the person who's co-located with the event in question, the event being the light getting back to the detector, there's no ambiguity. You know, there's no question about, there's no light travel time, there's no complications about simultaneity, because we've said things which are simultaneous at the same position are simultaneous absolutely. So it just, it ties up with the bow. There's no quibbles at this point. So that's why we have this profligate collection of observers everywhere, so that anything that happens in our frame, we've got an observer co-located, and it's their watch we pay attention to. So we could do it otherwise, but we don't. So yeah, but that, I think that's important to mention. And that last one is a bit of a red herring, because it's hard even to talk about the time of a photon. A photon doesn't have a clock, I mean, in a trivial sense. But also because it's moving actually at the speed of light, everything goes a bit, you know, 1/0 at that point. So we end up just not being able to say anything sensible about the time attached to a photon, because there's a sort of divided by zero problem, basically, when it comes down to it. It's not a mathematically sensible thing to talk about. Barbara. So that's what I scribbled down, that the time, the moving frame is, or the time in the quote stationary frame is gamma times the time in the moving frame or whatever. And when you do exercises, and you will be doing exercises, you'll write something like that, but you will lose marks if you are not clear what you mean by T and T prime, because it can be either way up. And the thing you remember is that it's called time dilation. Moving clocks run slow. And so you will work out, do I multiply or divide, essentially based on that. I mean, really, I suppose I should write delta T prime equals delta T over gamma. And as I say, that factor of gamma, you'll see again and again and again, enough that you won't even have to memorize it. You'll write it down so many times, it'll just stick in your heads. And that's what it looks like as a function. And you can see it's pretty close to 1 for most speeds from 0 up to the speed of light. It only gets to 2 at about just under 0.9 of the speed of light. So and this is why we never noticed it before the 19th century, because it doesn't make any difference until you're 90% of the speed of light, at which point it goes bananas. So it shoots up to infinity at the speed of light. So that's you have that picture in your head. Key points. Right. Now that is, I've gone through that rather quickly, actually. More quickly than I worried I would. So it's not worth starting on chapter 4, but I will post chapter 4 promptly. In the last couple of minutes, rather than hurry on, other questions, other really good questions like that that are boiling over in your head. Okay, then. Think of some. I'll post the notes. Have a look at them for next time. I think it's quite important to go through these the notes afterwards and make sure they make sense, because it's sort of thing where, oh yes, it made perfect sense, and then in half an hour you'll explain it to someone else and they'll go, I have no idea what was going on. So it is hard. It needs to settle down. I'll see you next Wednesday.